love this afternoon? Well, follow me. Hello, everyone. I'm Lauren Leibowitz, and welcome to Blog Talk Radio and How to Be Comfortable in Your Own Shoes. It's Thursday, May 17th, and once again, we are coming to you live from Los Angeles. It's a gorgeous day here, clear blue skies, and love is everywhere. So I want to thank you all for joining us today, and we'd love to hear from you, so please call in to listen live or ask those burning love questions I know you all have at 347-857-2710, and you can also email us here at the studio at goodvibeexperience@gmail.com. Once again, those 10 love digits are 347-857-2710. And here's a little exciting news I want to share with all of our listeners. We here at Shoes are taking our shoes in a different direction in the next few weeks, so keep your hands on that little internet mouse of yours for more information. Well, author of Learning to Breathe, Priscilla Warner, says of my guest today, she takes the mystery out of two mysterious subjects, the inner workings of our brains and the successful pursuit of true love. My guest is warm-hearted, love that, funny, and explains neuroscience in an easy, breezy manner and gives us a wonderful introduction to mindfulness meditation and its benefits. So fasten your seatbelts, because today you're going to rewire your brain for love. So please give a warm welcome to my guest today, Dr. Marcia Lucas. Hi, Marcia. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Good to be with you. I love the love digits. And they have to
Yeah, you didn't know there were 10 of them, did you?
I like it.
You know, new material keeps coming up. Feel free to borrow those 10 love digits.
And I'll credit you accordingly, of course.
Please, please. But you know what? Don't you wish it was kind of that easy if someone, a patient came to you and say, you know, Dr. Lucas, I'm experiencing difficulty finding someone, having a relationship or this relationship I'm in. Don't you think it would be nice? Well, here are those 10 digits, like a combo.
Here's the answer. Wasn't that Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, where the answer to the question of what's the meaning of life is 42?
That's right. That's a kind of a random number. But you know what? I think basically it's somehow that simple. The concept is. I don't think it's as difficult as we tend to make things. That's, I guess, one reason why you are so successful at what you do and why people come to you is because you have this secret language of the brain and how to unlock that steel door.
Wow, you're giving me a whole lot of credit. I would actually say...
Yeah, so you're not. Is this Marcia Lucas? If you're not the real Marcia Lucas, I'm sorry.
What I would say is that we all have the potential to increase quite a lot, actually, the ways in which we're able to access our own wisdom and the ways that we're able to change the way that we respond to the world so that we're not just doing it out of the habits that keep causing us such grief in so many relationships or in the same relationship, but over and over again in the same ways that, you know, by knowing what I know about the brain, it gives me a little bit of a leg up in helping others understand their brain and then to empower them, to make it different, to literally change it.
Yeah.
That's the amazing thing to me in the neuroscience research that's been done in mindfulness is that this is not just, you know, meditation is good for you and it reduces stress and all of the, you know, maybe helps reduce back pain but really truly changes the pathways in the brain, plumps up areas that are key to our well-being, to our mood states and you can do it.
What I so love about your book, Rewire Your Brain for Love, is that, as I mentioned to you a little bit before we went on air, that I have a yoga practice, and this yoga practice, I think like most of them, teaches us to dive inside, to look inside ourselves in that basement, uncover the junk that's covered with sheets and throw it out. And in your book, there's a heading of one of your chapters that you call Putting a Work Light in the Attic.
Yes.
And so can you tell us, how do we turn that light on?
Sure. Well, that particular chapter, what I do in the book is I take you through sort of one level in a way at a time, starting at the bottom of your brain and moving on up. And putting a work light in your attic is really talking about the benefit that comes from the mindfulness meditation, that comes from the brain changes that come from mindfulness practice, of insight, of self-knowing. And I'm not talking about, you know, the kind of navel contemplation and, you know, sitting in lotus position and getting to understand yourself and your, you know, what's the meaning of life, right? Doug Adams says 42. But really as a matter of being able to be attuned to yourself in any given moment and to kind of know what sorts of things your very busy monkey mind is up to, what sorts of information you might be missing or ignoring about what's going on in the moment, either in your brain or in your body or in the person that you're trying to have a discussion with that maybe is getting a little heated at the moment. And so being able to know enough about yourself in the moment and where some of that comes from. You know, my dad was also a psychologist, and he had gotten trained back when, you know, Freudian analysis was pretty much it. And he evolved, fortunately, as did the field of psychology and psychotherapy. So I'm not a Freudian. I'm not saying, you know, in knowing your history, you need to know how potty training went for you.
Yeah, that's right. That's really going back.
Right. But what I would say is actually going back even a bit farther, although you can't know it directly, you can know it from the sorts of practices in mindfulness meditation. You can know more about how you have taken in the first 18 months, really, of your being here as a baby, how your brain and body wired up for attachment, what your attachment style is.
You said in the first part of your book, you mentioned an interesting scenario about a baby that's crying and this mother, the mother of the baby, who has been up all night the night before, with headlines and caring for the child and is holding the baby and in her mind is trying to say, hush, honey, but is also saying,
sweetheart, and you coo to the baby and you gotta get to the call.
That's right, would you cut it out already? Snap on it, I'm tired. You know, Daddy and I haven't been alone for days. And
I'm not sure I want to be alone with Daddy anymore.
That's right. Look what happened. I got you and you're crying. And you suggest that even though this, I don't know how old this child is, not, you know, 2 months, but the emotional aspect of what the mother is feeling is passed through to the child.
Yeah. So we come into this world because, you know, unlike our, let's say, you know, reptile cousins in the animal world, we come into the world really, you know, pink and helpless. You know, it's just like we're this squirmy bundle of need. And part of that is the need to try to do whatever we can to be cared for. because otherwise we're going to die. You know, it's not like a turtle that hatches on the beach and then fends for itself and, you know, maybe 10% of them make it to the water. We humans stick around as parents and take care of our helpless little newborns. And because of that, we think, evolutionarily, we also developed this tremendous need for this inbred need and capacity for becoming attached. Because honestly, you know, why else would anyone in their right mind want to stay around this little helpless thing that is pooping and peeing and screaming and spitting up?
Was there something in a past life?
Right. You know, so some of it, obviously, you know, we want survival and, you know, passing our genes on, and there's that sort of, you know, evolutionary mandate. And part of it is also that there is a way that, you know, our brains, our bodies, our hormones are all designed to attach and connect, not just so that our little ones will survive, but also because we live in community. In order to survive as humans, we have to be able to be a part of something bigger than us. We have to have, you know, some sort of community or gathering, because if you think about it, if you weren't, right, and you got cast out of the group, you were out there facing the lions and whatever else on your own, and you would not survive very long, unless, of course, you found another clan. But one way or the other, you have to connect, you have to attach. And then, you know, the thing that my patients come in and, you know, we talk about their experiences that they can remember when they were younger about, you know, what might be some clues about what it was like to be connected and in relationship when you were little. And, you know, they say, well, you know, this is all good to understand, which it is, because then you start to have some insight.
Can you share with us what would be a common something?
And compassion? You know, my mom was, she always took good care of us. You know, she made sure we had the clothes we needed, the food we needed, we got to bed on time, but not so much with the warm and fuzzy, you know.
Right.
She was really about just getting the job done. That would be one thing, you know, and then, of course, it could go on to the more, you know, severe end of things where, you know, mom or dad would, you know, beat us on a regular basis, or, you know, I was in charge of taking care of my three-year-old sister when I was five, and my parents would go out. Those are, you know, the extreme scenarios. But it can really be, what I think the message I want to get across is, this is not about having bad parents. This is about having normal parents. I have a friend here in Washington, D.C. He's also a psychotherapist, psychologist that I respect a great deal. And when they ask him, when anyone asks him what his specialty is, he kind of gets this wry grin and says, I specialize in working with adult children of dysfunctional families. And, you know, right, everybody laughs. It's like everybody.
Everybody. I mean, I can't tell you. I'm sure there are people that have had a pristine or maybe, a beautiful childhood without any
angst. It just has to be good enough. It doesn't have to be pristine. It just has to be good enough. That's the good news.
Right.
But, yeah, most of us struggle, and you know, we complain about it, and we have insight into it. But really being able to get that insight, that's good. It's important. And then knowing that, you know, the best the research can tell us so far is that close to half of us had a pattern of attachment when we were younger that left us not so great. It left us with an insecure style of attachment that then follows us into and through adulthood unless we do something about it. And, you know, it's partly turning on that light in the attic of knowing what kind of stuff you have stored in there. And I'm not just talking about recovered memories or things like that. I'm just talking about knowing kind of what it felt like when you were a kid and what's your narrative? If you were going to write a movie of your life and how you got to be who you are, what would those things look like? And what would
how much time do we have?
What would the lighting be? Right, exactly. And so what's interesting is knowing that is extremely helpful. But sometimes we don't have the capacity to really tolerate sitting with that, so we kind of ignore it and say things like, "Oh well, you know, it's like every other childhood, you know," and by practicing the mindfulness meditation, you gain a greater capacity to sit with the feelings and to sit with maybe there's a subtle change in your body as you start to think about what that birthday party was like when you were six or how you felt about not having birthday parties or whatever it was. And you learn to read yourself and be attuned to yourself better. And then you know more, even if you don't have more facts or insight, you have a greater attunement and sense of yourself.
Well, you remind me of that Broadway song, Getting to Know You, that line from the Broadway
yes.
song, Getting to Know You.
Yes.
And I
getting
think,
to know all about you.
Yeah, but I think, why do you think a lot of us are so afraid to get to know us, to look within?
Well, sometimes it's sort of, you know, the same, different side of the same coin, right? It may be that you were raised in a family where, you know, talking about feelings was kind of nonsense, right? In my family, even though my dad was a psychologist, the thing that was prized above all was intellectual rigor, not so much with the talking about feelings, you know? And so that was, you know, kind of a tough thing because I had a lot of feelings and I didn't quite know what to do with them. And I thought I was supposed to talk about them. Isn't that what psychologists, you know, do for a living? And yet it was, if there were difficult feelings that came up, I could sense that my parents would get uncomfortable with it. So I steered away from it. So I learned to be tough and capable and very academically inclined, which served me well, got a PhD, but had a lot of ground to kind of go back over and say, oh, wait a minute, I was missing all of this other stuff. And how do I tune into that without feeling overwhelmed or being, you know, kind of anxious about it? So we learn a lot of this stuff early on, and by, you know, taking the reader through in the book, starting with the bottom up, kind of just that starting with the basic of what's going on in your body in response to feeling. You know, your partner comes home and is snarky. makes us, you know, first thing in the door, slams down the briefcase, makes a snarky comment, right? Your body responds to that before your mind has even registered it. Kind of like, you know, if a lion is chasing you, you don't stop and think first, gee, should I run?
Really? Excuse me, table for one, right? Mr. Lion?
Yes. Exactly. So the first thing that mindfulness helps with is helping you be better attuned to your body, and you get better body regulation going on. That then leads to better modulation ability to kind of regulate your fear response. And let me tell you something, fear runs our lives more than any of us would want to acknowledge. You were saying, why would people be afraid to sit and know? We are, again, we're designed, however you want to put it. We're put together in a way so that we have to be constantly assessing and evaluating the situation around us as to whether we're in danger or not. That's why I didn't step out, you know, onto the major road today in front of my office and get hit by a bus, right? Because I was vigilant about what was going on around me.
Have to also discern whether, you know, not to allow the fear to prevent us in moving forward, to take that
or
next
to
step.
Hijack us and have us retreat or attack or anything else, right? So if you've got the fear kind of naturally there, and a friend of mine who's also a neuropsychologist who teaches meditation, his name is Rick Hansen, he wrote a fabulous book called Buddha's Brain. And he talks about the brain being like Velcro for negative experiences and like Teflon for positive experiences, which I really
love.
Like.
But don't they say that if somebody, how does it go? It takes, and I think you're going to have the answer to this.
That's John Gottman, I think, talks about if you have a negative interaction with someone,
right.
I forget what his number is. I think it's something like it takes 6 positives to make up for it.
Right.
Yes. Right. And so it's the same thing. We're kind of biased. We have this negativity bias. And so if you're not paying attention and you're not able to modulate that and have a brain that's integrated so that you're aware when that's happening and the parts of your brain that can help calm things back down, if that's not all really smooth and integrated and wired in really fast and thick, then you end up in those messes over and over again. And fear, which is what we're talking about here, that vigilance, is really anger, right? Or anger is really fear, I should say. So the only time we really get angry is when,
they're dating,
in some way, we feel unsafe. I'm sorry?
I said fear and anger are dating?
Fear and anger are they're like kissing cousins. They're they're more than dating. They're more than dating.
It's serious.
They are two of the things that drive us without us really knowing it so much of the time. So much of the time. I mean, you know, go back to the Freudian thing again, right? Our defense mechanisms are defending us from danger, from fear. It's a way of kind of, you know, coping or strategizing about it. There's nothing wrong with having defense strategies that can come in helpful when, you know, your boss comes screaming at you and you have to not burst into tears. But you can't necessarily over-apply a defensive strategy if you want to get close to somebody.
That's right.
So then you have to get into, from the body regulation on through the fear modulation, you get into emotional resilience, so that even if you do get thrown off kilter and, you know, you have this reaction to your partner coming in and saying something crass or snarky or forgetting that they were supposed to be home for dinner or whatever it is that triggers you, that you can make more than just your typical habitual knee-jerk response, that you open up more possibilities because your brain's more integrated. You're bringing more of you to the table. One of the things is, you know, that I like to say is that the biggest enemy of relationships is autopilot, is kind of running the same old program, just hitting the button and going on autopilot. And we don't do that consciously. We have to be mindful in order to break out of autopilot.
And plus,
then you can bring the best of yourself. That's really what we're aiming
men
for.
Men and women have a different language. I just learned that.
I'm enough of a feminist that I don't want to say that it's just gender specific.
But there's part of it, because why do some women say, well, you know, Marge, my husband never listens to me. And I think there are certain parameters.
But is that simply because, you know, they have an X and a Y and we have 2 X chromosomes?
Not necessarily, but I sometimes think that you have to, it's an individual concept.
And
you
it's
have
what,
to understand who
learn.
That person is. Yeah.
Sure, it's what we learn, and you know, in a lot of the couples that I see, if I painted in really broad strokes and lost a lot of the detail, I would say that mostly women, if they have an insecure attachment style, it tends to be more in the anxious, ambivalent realm, which is to say they underneath it all sort of fear losing the attachment, and they work really hard to try to get attachment, however that might be. And then, again, really overly broad strokes, the guys tend to have, if they have an insecure attachment style, they tend to go more in the direction of being somewhat avoidant, saying, you know what, talking about emotions, not so much.
Not so
and
much.
Not
Pick
so much
number.
With the
we'll
getting
get back
close. Yeah, yeah. And what's interesting is the couples that I tend to see together are like, one of them is one style, one of them is the other, and that was the very thing that brought them together.
Right, so you're helping them rewire so they can better communicate, correct?
Yes, and it's really, you know, a lot of couples therapy for a long time was about teaching people to communicate. And I want to say that sometimes knowing, having something in your back pocket to say that's going to be, you know, calming things down or whatever, that can be a helpful thing. But it's a tool. And what I try to do is really get people to kind of change the whole foundation of whatever it is that you're working on so that you don't really need the tools as much. So as an example, if you have an anxious attachment style and you know that, you have the insight, and yet every time the guy that you went out with the night before doesn't call when he says he's going to, you're going back and forth and back and forth. Should I call him? Should I not? Is he into me? Is he not? And you get all torqued and hyped up and everything. If you have a tool, you know, you'll be able to say, all right, I'll call my girlfriend instead. And, you know, I'm not going to call him. I know that that's a bad thing and that's a tool. And when he does call, I'll say this, right? That's sort of helpful, but that's not really showing up with your best, most authentic self and living fully.
But that's
what
where the mindful meditation comes in, right?
That's right. So the regular practice of that, you're actually changing the pathways. So the pathways for the insecure attachment that I was just describing, the anxious attachment, sort of go from being super highways, you know, 10-lane super highways, to, you know, falling back a bit to being a simple 2-lane road. But the pathway that has to do with body regulation, fear modulation, emotional resilience, response flexibility, that insight and self-knowing, having empathy for yourself and the other person in equal measure, and really kind of shifting things around, then you're not struggling to try to use the tool, damn it, right? You're instead open and available in a very different way. And that is really the game changer.
That is a game. We're talking with Dr. Marcia Lucas, author of Rewire Your Brain for Love. I mean, it's just really so simple and so interesting, I think, in today's society. Somebody was telling me about, I think it's the latest Stephen King novel called 11/23/63, the date that JFK was assassinated. Mm. And they talk about 1958 as a time when, as you mentioned earlier, community, that, oh, hey, Marcia, how you doing? Sure, Lauren, what's going on? Oh, great.
Right.
See you later. Again, you know, stay in touch, whatever. Today,
oh, and face-to-face.
Face-to-face
real community.
FaceTime. Real FaceTime.
Real FaceTime.
And today there isn't much of that. I think technology has brought the world together, but it also keeps us apart.
In a way. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that, you know, even with, you know, I have a son, and when he was an infant, you know, I was a grown-up, you know, I had friends, I had family, I had community, and yet most of the day, it was me and the baby. I didn't have, you know, my mom living next door, and my grandmother up the street, and my aunties visiting, right? I didn't have that community of, you know, everyone who, you know, if I lived in, say, a village or the 1958 equivalent of a village, I didn't have that there. And I remember thinking, you know, I don't know how good this is, because even though I would, you know, I'd go out to the park and meet up with friends there, or I would, you know, go visit family or whatever, it wasn't the same. And there's a way that I think that takes a toll on us as caregivers. I think there's a way that our kids end up missing out in terms of being able to feel like not just one or two, but many people are attuned to them. One of the things that, you know, I said before about healthy, successful attachment it gives you all of these benefits that I'm talking about that you can get later using mindfulness meditation. But if you get it from the get-go, that attuned, you know, feeling like somebody gets you and responds to you in a way that's contingent on that, not 100% of the time, that's creepy, that's way over helicopter mom, right? But, you know, a good measure of the time that you feel like, okay, I'm safe, I'm lovable, I'm, you know, I'm well cared for, somebody gets me and responds to me in a way that makes sense, that is what gives you a sense of security. And if mom can't do it, you know, for, I don't know, a month at a time or a year at a time, that there used to be somebody else who could step in and do it.
Yeah, who looks like mom, or maybe, you know, it doesn't look like mom has hairy legs, but, you know, has
right.
motherly instincts.
And you made a great point there. This does not have to be mom. Dads are completely just as capable of doing this sort of, you know, attuned, contingent response.
Well,
and
it's so funny because on Mother's Day, we went to a local racetrack, and there was that doesn't sound
interesting,
right?
Interesting choice.
Does it? Okay, all righty then. Not dropping your children off at my house. There was a young security guard, and he says to me, "Happy Mother's Day," and I said, "Well, Happy Mother's Day to you too." And he looked at me like I'm a father. I have a son. I said, "That's wonderful." I said, "Please take this the right way." I don't know exactly what I said, but I said, "But you are nurturing and guiding him and loving him, but you're the dad. You do the same thing. I mean, you have Dad's Day. So you do the same thing that, you know, a mother does." And he said, "Okay, got it." Got it.
Well, you know, and the other thing is that when you've got this sort of, what you were feeling was this sort of mutual, you know, empathic response, right? He was wanting to give you something sweet, at what level or what, whether it's politeness, I don't know, but we'll give him the benefit of the doubt. You know?
Right.
And you were wanting to reflect that back. And he didn't quite get it. Maybe you weren't as attuned to him, you know, being a macho guy. Maybe wishing the Happy Mother's Day really pissed him off. I don't know.
That's right. He was carrying a baton around his waist.
Right, there you go.
I should have noticed.
But I think that, you know, your impulse to say to him, you know, we're all in this together, is the most wonderful and subversive part of, you know, becoming more mindful. It doesn't turn you into a wuss. It doesn't turn you into a wimp that, you know, you know, we're all going to stand around and hold hands and sing Kumbaya. But what it does do is help you shift your perspective from fear and survival and, you know, all of the things that motivate companies to scare you into buying their products or motivate sometimes politicians into frightening and, you know, you into believing particular things. It allows you to sort of step back and say, you know what, I'm not going to let fear run the show. I'm going to make a decision that feels right to me.
Because I only have a minute left, and I want to get those love digits and love websites out there for you so people can contact you, because you're just a fascinating woman and
have
so much to share. So that's MarshaLucasPhD.com, and also RewireYourBrainForLove.com. You're also on Facebook, so people can put in Marsha Lucas and find you. It's been deliciously delightful and so lovely. Please come back on the show some other time. We'd love to have you.
It's been delightful. Thank you, Lauren.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Dr. Marsha Lucas, author of Rewire Your Brain for Love. Dr. Lucas can be discovered at MarshaLucasPhD.com or RewireYourBrainForLove.com. This is Lauren Leibowitz and How to Be Comfortable in Your Own Shoes. And join me next time for a wild and crazy journey when my guest will be mystery guest. Don't you love a mystery? I do. Thank you so much for joining me today and listening to How to Be Comfortable in Your Own Shoes. We'll see you next time, and I look forward to helping you find comfort in your own shoes. We'll leave you with Flight of the Monarchs by Keith Chagall.